Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. I know you guys miss me. I'm back. Don't worry. Here I am. All is good in the world again. Trevor Anderson, chart manager here at Billboard, joined by my my friend and featured host, Gary Trust.
Co-lead artist.
I don't know. You might need to check that. You might have that featuring in front of your name.
And yeah, that's right. You weren't here last week. That's right. I forgot.
No, I was. Yeah, no, I had to cancel some dates. I heard through the grapevine, and I guess literally, that I had a nice fill-in from our friend Andrew Unterberger, a senior editor on our digital coverage of Billboard.com. So Andrew holding down the fort. I think he, was not a perfect fill-in. Who could be? But, 9 out of 10. Got the job done. Still got the W.
Yeah, Andrew, last week filled in, and if you listen, Trevor, we talked about, really got a whole discussion of who's had the best year ever on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, because last week Drake set a record. He passed Usher for the most weeks any artist has ever spent at number one on the Hot 100 in a year. He had 29 so far this year, and passed Usher with 28 weeks at number one in 2004. So we wanted to talk about that, just who, in terms of pop culture impact, does it feel like has had the biggest year on the Hot 100? At the end, we felt that Beatles, 1964, Michael Jackson, 1983, were maybe the top two years, along with Elvis, 1956, but that was before the Hot 100 Hot 100 started. But I put it to a vote afterwards on Twitter. I wanted to see what people thought. Michael Jackson, he was the runaway winner, got 54% of the votes for his 1983. The Beatles were second with 22%. Drake was third with 17%. And Usher was fourth, 7%. Is that poor Usher? Is that surprising, Trevor? A lot of people said, some of the comments kind of along the lines of, I wasn't alive when the Beatles had that big year, so I'm going to vote for Michael Jackson. That's kind of the one I can relate to. So I think there's some sort of a, I won't say recency bias, because it's 1983, but kind of along those lines.
Obviously, Michael Jackson has had this sort of new level of reverence attached to him since he died almost 10 years ago. So certainly people are sort of looking back at his contributions and his influence that much more. I mean, obviously, it was still very prevalent through the last years of his life. I mean, really, Michael Jackson, changed the template for pop stars. We weren't looking for the Bruce Springsteens and Bob Dylans anymore. People wanted Michael Jackson's right. Glamour, image, you can dance, you're smooth, you're, good looking, all that kind of stuff. Beatles, yeah, I mean, I think certainly the Beatles are one of those bands where you know sort of their magnitude, you know the records, you know the numbers, but certainly if you weren't alive to experience that phenomenon, I mean, I think even today, some of those numbers that Beatles and Elvis Presley are putting forward, some of these things where it's when they were on Ed Sullivan or whatever, it's one in every three households was watching that. And yeah, it's just one of those facts that you almost, today you cannot wrap your mind around that. There's no event, short of the Super Bowl, where it feels like everybody is watching, one in three people, 50 million people are watching this show.
Timing was on their side. Beatles and Elvis had that benefit of being at the beginning, so they kind of just set the whole stage for the next 60 years of pop music. So, that was sort of it was their talent, obviously, but just to be able to have that reach because it was so new. So that's something that, Drake and Usher obviously just don't have that newness about that. I was a little surprised that Usher only got 7%. It was 14 years later, I guess. Pop culture wise, just hasn't aged maybe as well as we might have thought.
Well, I don't think it's a question of. I think. I mean, for me, I don't think that's a judgment on Usher himself. I just think it's one of those things where in 2004, you know, Usher met the moment. He, you know, obviously had a huge list of hit makers and songs, and he was the centerpiece, and he made that moment of R&B what it was. And it had some influence, of course, you know, Chris Brown, Trey Songz that come after. But I don't know that it sort of made, it was a great album, great moment, but I don't know if it necessarily transcended in a way that Michael and Elvis and the Beatles and such have. I mean, even if you look at Drake, you can even say now, a lot of people think that Drake is certainly one of the biggest architects. I don't think he really started the sing rap hybrid genre bending that we're seeing, but because it was such a big proponent of that, we see that now obviously everywhere from this new generation. So I'm not surprised that, if you want to say in terms of pop culture impact, that Usher would come in fourth in that race. Again, I don't think that's people saying that Confessions is not as good an album, or that Year wasn't as good,
right,
or that he isn't as good as those three. I think it's just, if you say influence and longevity, that probably is right.
Yeah, demo-wise, too, the people voting, a lot of people voting probably weren't born when the Beatles were first out. And if you're, you know, 18 years old, you were four in 2004. So
stop. I was thinking he was going to say like 12, but you're right.
Yeah.
That was 14 years ago.
Yeah. So maybe you know, a lot of young people voting, they just, you know, Usher's an oldie to them.
I wonder
at this point.
If young people like in that group, like, what do they think of Confessions? Like, do they know it? Because, you know, if you grew up with Confessions, you kind of revere it because you remember how big a moment that was. People played it, yada, yada. But if you're like, you know, 20, let's say, and it wasn't an album that you heard, did you go back and listen to it? The way that I wasn't alive when Thriller came out, but of course when I was 9, 10, I discovered it. I mean, did Confessions, is it one of those things where you just, if you were in that moment, you know it, but if not, maybe...
I think it's a little...
I don't know.
We were saying this last week. I think it's a little tied to the moment at this point, because that kind of R&B, it just isn't, it isn't as big nowadays. So... yeah, I think it winds up being a little bit tied to the early 2000s, whereas Michael Jackson feels pretty timeless. And again, yeah, ever since his death, that music has just gone to a whole new level in terms of newer audiences. I was a little surprised Drake, 17%. I would have maybe thought that for the moment he's having in really the last 10 years, might have been a little bit higher, but 17%.
Maybe. I mean, especially with some of these new artists, of course, there's people on, you know, for as many people, I think, who listen to Drake, appreciate Drake, like Drake, there is this contingent that is, you know, thinks he's oversaturated, overabundant, maybe a little too much too soon, not developing enough, thinking that, you know, his past couple albums have kind of, you know, tried around the same kind of formula, a few surprises here and there. But as far as, you know, I've seen some people like to take that. I've seen some people put on those takes online that, you know, Drake doesn't have a classic album. He's just a guy who makes a lot of hit singles and, you know, he can run the table for the moment. But in 10, 20 years, no one's going to be thinking, oh, you know, that was a great Drake album. So, I mean, I'm not terribly surprised. And part of it also might be sort of the pop culture historians leading the way, that of course we revere Michael, of course we revere the Beatles. So right. You feel like you almost have to vote for them. Like, you know, everyone thinks Michael Jackson was that influential. How am I going to say, no, he wasn't the best of the best?
Well, if you're in the discussion, it's a good thing. No matter how much you got in the vote, that still means you had a huge year. So yeah, fun chatting about it last week with Andrew and all the Twitter votes as well. So this week on the podcast, coming up, a really excited special guest, country singer-songwriter Chris Jansen, currently in the country airplay charts top 10 with Drunk Girl. And we have him coming up here on the podcast, along with Warner Music Nashville CEO and chairman John Esposito, both interviewed by Billboard's Nashville-based senior chart manager Jim Asker in Nashville. They talked a couple days ago. So that's coming up. It's actually a new number one on the Billboard Hot 100. So after all this Drake talk, a new number one. Let's talk about that too. Here's this week's Top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Number 10.
Back in high school, I used to bust it to the dance.
Yeah!
Now I hit the FBO with duffels in my hands.
Number 9.
I didn't have a Zan, 13 hours till I land. Had me out like a light, ay, like a light, ay, like a light.
I don't really want no friends.
Number 8.
I don't really want no friends.
He trying to 69 like Tekashi. Call him Papi, worth the ASAP. Keep me rocky. I'm from New York, so I'm cocky.
Such a fucking hoe. I love it.
Number 7.
You're such a fucking hoe. I love it.
You're such a fucking hoe. When the first time they ask you, you want
to beat it up like pinata.
Number 6.
Turn the job, close the curtains. Bad bitch, make you nervous.
Como Celia Cruz, tengo el azúcar.
I say that I am better now, better now.
Number 5.
Only say that cause you're not around.
To destroy it, lethal injection, go to sleep 6 feet deep. I give you a beat for the effort, but if I was 3 foot
number
11,
three.
You look up to me, and for the record, you would suck a dick to fucking be me for a second. Lick a ball sack to get on my channel. Give you a
do you love me? Are you riding?
Number 2.
Never ever leave from beside me, cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always, KB. Do you love me? Are you
like you got to find you, me, do what I want when I.
And number 1.
All right, so our friend Gary over there is not a liar. That is a brand new song at the tail end of that countdown for the first time in 11 weeks. We got a new number 1. That is Future Super Bowl headliners Maroon 5 featuring Cardi B. And the song is Girls Like You. I think people have been kind of watching, as we have. That song's been number 2 for the past 6 weeks. So the big question was it going to have enough energy, enough momentum behind it to overtake In My Feelings, which had been number 1 for the past 10 weeks? And this week we have our answer.
So both songs are actually falling. It's just that Girls Like You fell a little bit less this week. Only 3%, Drake's down 9%. So
sometimes just kind it's of, a marathon, not a sprint.
It just kind of waited out for the total hysteria of In My Feelings to come down a little bit. And radio is really driving this one. We've seen a lot this year. Streaming is the main metric for songs at number 1. But over half the points for Girls Like You this week are from radio. That's been number 1 on the radio songs chart for 9 weeks now, Girls Like You. So radio helps Maroon 5 get to number 1. First pop song at number 1.
Yes,
after 34 weeks.
Our friend Gary is so excited about that. We almost could have carried a baby to term with just not us because we physically cannot, but somebody,
glad you clarified that,
could have almost carried a baby to term with just rap songs at number 1. The last pop song to be number 1 on the Hot 100, was 34 weeks ago.
Yeah, it was
stuck right in there.
Well, it was similar in some ways because it was waiting at number 2 for a while too, and it felt like a huge hit, and it finally was able to sneak in. So Havana, Camila Cabello.
Yeah, all the way back in January, and since then it's just been sort of a rotating wheelhouse between Drake and Post Malone and Childish Gambino. XXXTentacion got in there for a week, and of course Cardi B, Bad Bunny, J Balvin on the song I Like It. So all those songs spending time at number 1 in between, and a new season. We're back in fall. Feels like a time for a new number 1.
Do we know what the next number 1 is going to be? Because now that In My Feelings is down and Girls Like You is now number 1, could it be Eminem's Killshot debuts at number 3, but it kind of feels like it's going to be more of a one-week hit. Lucid Dreams is really gaining. I suppose that's a possibility.
Yeah, Lucid Dreams. Who would have thought? It's a song that was really blowing up on streaming services a few months ago. And, you know, in particular, as we've seen with a lot of these songs that have come out of the viral sphere from SoundCloud, hopping onto Spotify and such, radio really slow to react to those. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, especially because he's a new artist and, you know, very young, it felt like this was going to be a streaming driven hit and it would fall off, you know, fall off the chart by the time radio caught up a little bit, if it even was going to. And here we are. It's, you know, still in the top five. It's still in the top five. Streaming, you know, is still there, but it's not the same kind of monster it was a few months ago. And radio, to my surprise, really kicking in on this.
Yeah, it hits the radio songs top 10 this week. Pop radio has really come around in the song. You know, it's samples, Sting song from 1993, Shape of My Heart. So that backing
track. I'm sure the programmers were, you know, grabbing onto that one. Let's, woo, here we go.
But it's melodic. It's I think it's just been one of those slow build songs. So maybe that challenges the gap really throughout the entire top five isn't that huge at the moment. So yeah, kind of seems like it's in play. Back to Maroon 5 at number one. Do you know what an edgelord is, Trevor?
An edgelord?
Yeah.
No. It sounds like some sort of bad, like, rejected Avengers character or some, you know, Star Wars, some governing body in Star Wars or something. I don't know.
No, I just learned this term, and I thought when I learned it, I'd be like, ooh, I'll say it, and I'll impress Trevor. He'll be like, oh, I've known that word for, I'm surprised you don't know it. It's in internet slang for someone who says something kind of edgy or risque to drive clicks to get attention.
I really hate the internet so much.
I'm teaching a millennial.
I can't, internet slang. It is 100% an internet word. I don't know what an edgelord. What a, oh God. Right, okay.
Well, I'm going to be one, apparently. Is Maroon 5, are they a potential Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band? And I know maybe when you hear that, it kind of seems, yeah, they're a pop band. They don't have that cred. But you look now, they've had number ones for 11 years. First one, this is their fourth. The first one was back in 2007 with Makes Me Wonder. They've adapted. They've had Cardi B now. They bring rappers onto songs now. That's how they help stay relevant. Is it crazy to think that? So 2002 is their first album. 2027 is the year they'll be eligible. Are we talking about Maroon 5 in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I am going to sell on that. I'm going to sell that stock. I'll give you a caveat. Because I think, in some ways, for some of those reasons you mentioned, that kind of seemingly disqualifies them in some respects. Yes, they're a pop band. Not a whole lot of pop bands who don't have some sort of other attachment, you know, whether it's new wave, whether it's obviously like rock, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, even if you look at like a Blondie or somebody sort of disco experimental, all the bands have some sort of other adjective that kind of goes with them. And Maroon 5 might just be a little too middle of the road. I don't know if rap features are going to save them. And some people may argue, you know, if it's the rap feature that's keeping you relevant, are you relevant in that sense?
Yeah.
You mentioned the number ones, which, you know, is not. There are obviously plenty of people in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that have had number ones, but I don't think it's one of those things where number ones gets you into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I don't know if that's, you know, how much that was sort of weigh with the judging committee or whatnot. Adam's TV profile. It almost feels like the, you know, if you want to think of bands in terms of, you know, sell-ins and sell-outs, I mean, all those things, well, they have to get the rappers on to be relevant. Well, they have all these number ones. Well, he's always on TV. Well, they're just like a pop band who, you know, they started out kind of rock and they lost themselves. It all feels kind of like that to me might be a little hard to impress, you know, what people traditionally have thought of as, you know, some of the more influential bands to get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think the biggest thing, too, though, is if you look in terms of influence, I mean, it's one thing already, I think, on the landscape that a lot of bands are not coming out. So, you know, there aren't going to be a lot of successors to Maroon 5. And there aren't really any acts out there who are, you know, I mean, who's saying, you know, for better or for worse, oh, we listen to a lot of Maroon 5, we're influenced by Maroon 5. I don't know if they're going to have that kind of long tail, maybe a la what we're talking about with Usher Confessions, to where it feels like, oh, Maroon 5 opened the door for who?
Yeah. You know, I think of a band like Chicago that it took decades for them to get in, and then sort of similar evolution where they started rock, became, you know, pretty middle of the road. I love them, a pop band. And yeah, that sometimes isn't what the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voters are looking for. Talk about ruling your era, though, among bands. And that's all you can really compare over, you know, what will be those 25 years. They're kind of the only pop band with any kind of longevity in the 2000s. The last pop band to be number one before this week was Magic with Rude, you know, basically one-hit wonders at this point. And then after going back before that was Maroon 5 with One More Night. And before that in 2011, they had Moves Like Jagger. So they're kind of the only pop band this decade that's having any kind of major success on the charts. And if you look at it in terms of how far ahead are they above their competition of their era, it's kind of no question that they're the only pop band. If you want a band that's going to represent 2010's pop, it's Maroon 5. It's pretty unquestioned.
Now, to that point, I guess I did say I would give you a little caveat. I will say, you know, it's funny that you keep using the word pop for Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I find, like, you keep talking about, like, you know, no band rules pop the way they do. I mean, this isn't the Pop Hall of Fame, right?
It, by default, kind of is. I mean, that's always been, yeah, that's always, I mean, been, that's always been the argument, what exactly is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, you know, when the Beach Boys are in, they're a rock band, they're a pop band. There are so many pop acts. Chic, I mean, yeah. Nile Rodgers. So,
Pet Sounds did a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
To get them in. I do think, though, and, you know, maybe this is one of those things where timing will work out in their favor, is that, you know, I'm looking at this, I guess, from sort of like the current day Rock and Roll Hall of Fame standards, where you have plenty of acts from the 70s, 60s, 80s, who people would want to induct. When we move forward, these, you know, this another decade before they get in, I mean, that well is probably going to dry up to a pretty large degree. And what people, you know, may consider as worthy for Rock and Roll Hall of Fame certainly can change. You know, there's a lot of people even today who are upset that, you know, certainly a number of R&B acts and people of that genre and that era are not represented well on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, you know, with a leadership change, with a new generation, certainly when that pool of sort of classic rock and rollers dies out, because for all intents and purposes, you know, rock music is shrinking. It feels like more and more every year. So maybe, you know, Maroon 5 and, you know, even Outkast or Destiny's Child or some of these groups get a fresh look, a new consideration, and maybe in 10 years we'll look back and say, you know, oh yeah, Maroon 5, like they fit the ballot for what Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is. Today's standards, 2018, I think, especially as those rock purists try and hold on as much as they can, today, if they were up for it, I do not see them getting it.
Destiny's Child, they'll be in first, man. You're making your trip to Canton to go see Destiny's Child?
If in? Beyonce shows up for the induction, I show up for the induction.
Eminem, too. You talk about just some of the acts with the longevity. Yeah, Eminem could make it in. Again, not rock, but what we think. But yeah, great point about how rock, the rock era, is certainly changing. And yeah, what rock bands will make it in? And if they did, they wouldn't have that same kind of mainstream appeal. It would start to look a little, we're just bringing rock bands in. Whether they had that kind of mainstream success or not, it's kind of weird to think of acts like 3 Days Grace and Disturbed, some of the biggest acts in rock over the last 10, 15 years. They don't have that crossover appeal. So there's going to have to be some decision made by the voters. Are we sticking with rock, or are we going to bring in rap and hip-hop? And
well, yeah, pop, I mean, is, I guess, you know, is Rock and Roll Hall of Fame supposed to be a rock and roll era, which technically we're still in the rock and roll era, and there's a whole debate sort of, you know, around if that's even the right name for this current moment of music, or is it a Rock and Roll Artist Hall of Fame, or is it, you know, which one is it? It seems like we're leaning more towards the era, and to that point, I think Eminem is 100% going to get in. I mean, that seems like a no-brainer whenever he's eligible, just because if you look at the long tail in terms of not only the, and I know I kind of use this argument in some ways against Maroon 5, but when you look at the numbers, I mean, hot take, for whatever you like, better or worse, you know, Eminem popularized rap around the world in a way that I don't think any other artist up until that moment had. And I know there's people out there, well, of course, because he's a white artist, he was more accepted, and that certainly can play a part in it. But, I mean, he did. He was the biggest, you know, in the early 2000s. That was the guy. He was selling out like crazy, all the albums that he moved. And I think in terms of his influence, his longevity, I mean, this diss track he puts out debuts at number 3. People are still, you know, 20 years into his career, viscerally into to that Slim Shady persona, right? He represents how skilled he is in writing his rhymes behind the mic. I mean, that's just a total package artist. And, you know, unlike maybe Maroon 5, I mean, the list of rappers, not only who are influenced by Eminem, but his contemporaries who all, you know, Eminem is a top 5, easy. My favorite rapper is Eminem. If you're putting N.W.A. and you're seeing more acceptance of rap artists into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I mean, within his first 3 years, if it takes that long, I'm calling Eminem going to be inducted. Will he show up? I don't know, but he'll be in there.
All right. Songs About Jane, Maroon 5's first album, was released June 25th, 2002. So we'll pick up the discussion June 25th, 2027. Moving on this week to our special guest, really excited to have Chris Jansen, currently in the Country Airplay Charts Top 10 with Drunk Girl. Another great get-together by Jim Asker, where he gets artists together with label executives and kind of have these conversations that maybe sometimes they themselves never really think about to this degree. So going to hear about how an artist gets signed, a really interesting story of how Chris Jansen got signed to Warner Music Nashville. He's up for 3 CMA Awards coming up November 14th is the ceremony, a Song of the Year for Drunk Girl, Video of the Year for Drunk Girl, New Artist of the Year. Chris actually talks about even being in that category because he's been around for more than just 1 year. What's it like when an artist is called new when they know they've been doing this maybe for their whole life for a lot of people? So lots coming up here from Nashville. Really happy to hear from Jim Asker, our Nashville-based senior chart manager, talking with Warner Music Nashville CEO and chairman John Esposito and Chris Jansen here coming up on the Billboard Choppy Podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cover chart stamps, got a hand looking like a rainbow. In and out of every bar, on a whim just like the wind blows. She's either a bachelorette or coming off a breakup. Take a drunk girl home. She's bouncing like a pinball, singing every word she never knew.
Well, hello, this is Jim Asker on the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast, and my guest today, Warner Music Nashville, Chairman CEO John Esposito. John, hello.
Hello there, Jim. How you doing?
And the one and only Chris Jansen, who I've been wanting to talk to for a long time, and I got you right at the time, I think, because we got a lot to talk about.
Well, thank you very much. Proud to be here with both of you.
I just want to talk about, first of all, the 3 CMA Award nominations. And congratulations on that. How exciting.
I'm kidding.
I want to know where you both were when you heard about it. Espo, you first.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was at my house. I have been sick from work, I think about 10 days in my now 40-year career, and this was one of them. So I'm laying in bed and my phone is blowing up because it was a very good day for the label overall. But
yes, it was.
Chris getting 3 was just an amazing part of the magic of that day.
And tell everybody what they are, the 3.
Best New Artist, Song of the Year for Drunk Girl, and the Video of the Year for Drunk Girl.
And Drunk Girl is, I looked at the chart this morning, it's top 10 with us,
41 Weeks Young. We going to get that into number one?
It's our damned aim. I'll tell you that.
I was telling someone before, that song so far eclipses the chart position, though.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk about how that song started and your co-writers. And
well, it was, we were, it was the first day, actually, that Tom Douglas, Scooter Caruso, and I got together for the first time to write together, which is an amazing collaboration, turns out. But I kind of sensed it would be. I mean, it's either going to go one way or the other. It's going to be really bad or it's going to be really good. And it was really great. So,
who had the idea?
Tom. Tom brought it in. He had just been to the penitentiary in Davidson County, and you know, he had, I think he had said in so many words, I think he had said something to the effect of, you know, take a drunk girl home or something in passing, and he was there with his son shooting a documentary. And so the story goes, the sheriff, the chief there at the prison said, you know, to Tom's son, if 90% of the guys in this building would have just done what your father just said in a phrase, they wouldn't be in here for the next 35 years of their life, which was, you know, just making a mistake. And we all make mistakes, but I mean, those are pretty serious things sometimes, you know, when you, if you take advantage of someone, if you just do, if you just harm somebody in general, or you do the wrong thing. And so Tom got back and he kind of had an intense aura about him that morning, and so he let it out, the title, and Travis and I, or Scooter, if you will, we both were like, whoa. I mean, it was kind of a 50-50. We really want to write this, and 50% we're really scared, and we don't even want to get near that. But we did, and thanks to Tom, man, he can usually sell me on anything by getting on the piano and just starting to play, because yeah, like a Tom Waits side of Tom Douglas comes alive, and it really just steals the room. And so, you know, when you got the guy who wrote House That Built Me, you sort of have to listen. You just follow along. And we did, and we just put our dad's perspective mentalities together, and that's really where the song came from. Tom played, Scooter played guitar, mostly with his eyes closed, sitting on the couch. I just stood up and started singing words, and the song was written.
Awesome.
That's really true.
The message for anybody who's not aware of the song, Drunk Girl, from a listener's point of view, what's the message of that song?
That you have a girl who literally is drunk, and you could take her home and take advantage of her, or you could do the right thing, which is take her home and put the keys in the counter, write her a note, and go lock the door. And, you know, when you started this with the 41 Weeks Young, you know, our friends at radio do their best to get research, and research quite often happens in what's called a 7-second call-out research, and you can't really get the message of the song across in a 7-second call-out research, because the blowback has been people who didn't actually take the time to listen to the lyrics.
7 seconds. Who's available to take those calls these days?
Well, by the way, I'd love to know that too.
Me too.
You know, but at the end of the day, we persevered because we knew how powerful the song is and the message of the song. And we had some brave programmers who, despite the research, kept plowing it through. And then it just became familiar because they understood what the message of the song was. And they hear the hook in this call-out research and allowed it to climb the charts. But we probably could have chopped 20 weeks off if it weren't for that
it's
process.
A hit. At some point,
it's an important song on top of being a hit. He'll be playing this in concert for the rest of his life.
Just an inside baseball, an inside baseball chart perspective, because I do the charts, the country charts for Billboard. You know, there's the death walk, the death march period, the 40s, 30s, where it's songs got to get through. And that song, such a great song. We all thought it was a great song, all of my colleagues and I.
Thank you.
And then we were watching it slowly climb, and all of a sudden it just kicked in. And it's also doing well on Hot Country Songs as the hybrid chart, digital sales, streaming, and airplay. And that's the consumption chart, and it's doing great in both those metrics.
Well, thank you. It's It's great to hear you say that, and it's definitely a compliment. So I appreciate that. I generally just kind of stay out of those kinds of circles.
I know.
So when I do hear them, though,
I've never seen you in my circles.
And when it's a pleasant review like that, I really appreciate it because
it's,
you know,
so great.
You don't always get those.
Well, we just want you to be creative. Trust us to
that's what I'm doing.
The dirty work, I'll tell you. That death march that you described on the song. I want your audience to know that one of the most important awards in any of the award show, but we'll focus on the CMAs, is Song of the Year.
I was going to ask you, can you explain who the awards go to? Song of the Year, Video of the Year. Obviously, we know the new artist of the year. Espo, the Song of the Year goes to the writers?
It goes to the writers. And we celebrate the artist, and he happens to be both in this case. You know, quite often a Song of the Year will not have whoever performed it go there. But we don't have scientific proof of this, but you can look at what songs have won Song of the Year in the last decade, including Tom Douglas, one of the greatest writers ever's House That Built Me. And they are important songs. They actually tend to be more ballads or mid-tempo, and there's a powerful message in the song. And it's rarefied air to get there.
Well, I was in radio a long time, 20 years as a programmer, and remember when we would actually do auditorium tests, spend a lot of money to do auditorium tests. People would come into a room, and you'd have their attention, and you'd play a series of songs for them, and they'd rate them. And 90% of your top research songs would be ballads. So when radio guys would say to me, you know, we need tempo, I'd be like, okay, you play the best song. You know, the smart people know that the best song is what you play, and take it from there. And I just want to ask you about, you know, taking it to the listener, the fans, the important people, some of the stories you've gotten about the song Drunk Girl.
I think the most important story I have for you is, and I won't say his name, but I had a young man come to me in a meet and greet, and a lot of times, as this career has grown and it's gotten bigger and bigger, you know, people bring a lot of things in their hands for you. Now you got to be careful of what you take, obviously, because of the world we live in, you never know what somebody's handing you. But I trust my people pretty much for the most part, and this kid brought me this envelope, and I'm thinking, oh God, song lyrics, you know, which I can't do. And there's just a nice balance. But I opened it up in front of him, and I could see that it was a letter. So I put it back in there. I said, I'll read this later. And I did. And I went on the bus, man, and it broke us all down. I remember we sent it to everyone on the team, and it was an incredible thing, how Drunk Girl touches people. This young man wrote a letter. He's a high school senior. He said, look, I live in a community. It's pretty upscale. There's a lot of guys my age and kind of in my bracket. They got a lot of money. Of course, you know that when you have a little bit more money than some, you can do a lot more with it. You can have a lot more fun sometimes. That's true. He said, but it kind of gives them a feeling of entitlement, and that they can do anything in circles with women as well. And I really just don't stand for any of that. And I appreciate the song. I appreciate the song being a message that my peers are hearing, and it's changing the face of it. It's changing the game of it. And man, I was blown away. First of all, it takes courage for anybody to say that of any age. Secondly, it takes extreme amounts of courage for a high school student to say it when you're vulnerable and awkward anyway in high school, and you don't know where you fit in. And if you do make the right stand, people usually hate you for it. So I thought that was really just amazing. And I've gotten more and more of those letters and those messages, and I keep track of that stuff because it's important. I mean, it really is. I mean, you don't ever, you know, you don't get those kinds of messages with Buy Me a Boat. You don't get them with Fix a Drink. You don't get them with, you know, other hit songs. So a song like this only comes around once in a lifetime, and you have to really, it's not about capitalizing on it. It's about just really taking it in for what it is. Really, the song capitalizes off of you, because, you know, I have to be the one who sells it, obviously being the one who wrote it.
What's the reaction when you do it? When you're performing,
it, you know, my show is so high energy, it's crazy. People are just frantically freaking out, and just, you know, it's a rowdy, raucous kickback to like mid 80s Hank Jr. kind of thing, the rowdy parts. But then I slow it down, and I usually preface. I'm of the belief that people, you know, they're familiar with Drunk Girl now because it's a hit on the radio, and it's a global hit, but in the building process of this, I preface it with something that's already accustomed to their ears. So I usually intro it with a little bit of Billy Joel's Piano Man, harmonica and piano, and then I go into a little journey like Don't Stop Believing. And that just makes people comfortable. When people are comfortable, then they're ready to hear. If they're not comfortable, they're going to have a wall up. And so when I play Drunk Girl for them, I will do a little preface of that, and then I will say, okay, now listen. And then all of a sudden, everybody's like, yeah, okay, now I'm going to listen. And they get serious. And I mean, I see a lot of tears. I see a lot of lights in the air naturally. You know, I know that it's touching heartstrings because it's touching mine. And so if it's touching mine, it must be touching someone else.
How does it feel to you as an artist when you're performing a song that impactful and you hear the quiet?
It feels very well because I'm going to be honest with you. I'm the kind of artist who gets so entranced in what I'm doing. I don't mean that like it's about me, but truly when I'm on stage,
well, it's you, you know,
truly so. When I'm on stage, exactly. I'm such an A personality. I can't help it.
You're that's giving just, those people an escape.
That's how I perform though. Yeah. Like I go into some kind of weird alternate world and I don't even know what I'm doing, between the dancing and the singing and whatever. But Drunk Girl gives me a second to just calm down and just really sing. I mean, I like to think I'm a pretty good singer. So, I don't do that a lot during my shows. A lot of it's just really high energy, raucous, crazy, rowdy hit music. But Drunk Girl gives me a different perspective. I get to sing. I really feel the emotion with people. And you don't have to. Here's the great thing about Drunk Girl. You don't have to sell it to people. All you have to do is play it for people. And so there's a big difference in songs like that and songs that you have to sell to people.
Great music is timeless.
Yep.
That song's going to be around for a long time.
Thank you.
A lot of songs that we hear today in all genres won't be around, but that one will. Espo, describe his stage show, Chris Jansen's stage show.
Well, I will, and then I'm going to come back to Drunk Girl.
But, well, you want to start with the Drunk Girl and then go?
Well, no. I should be able to remember the thought I had in my head, but, you know, I didn't, when we signed Chris, and I know we'll go back to Buy Me a Boat and the
yes,
whole
we are.
Launch of his career. I was blown away by what he does on stage because, you know, he's been described as the Mick Jagger of country. You know, just his energy is without bounds when he's up there on the stage, and it's really fun to watch. It's what's gotten people, I think, like Keith Urban and Tim McGraw to proclaim publicly that he will be Entertainer of the Year because he's that level. He's considering, you know, we base so much of our measurements on number one records. He's selling more tickets than a lot of artists who have more than two number one records. People with 10 number one records are not getting the reaction in concert and the literally hard ticket sales that Chris is because his show is so compelling.
If I could interject for just a moment, I was telling Chris before we started recording that the first time I saw Chris play was on the New Faces show. I know he's up for New Artist of the Year. And I was telling him, you know, as an industry person, how jaded those shows can be because it's an all-industry crowd. And a lot of it is slow and fatiguing and a lot of inside stuff, jokes. And he got on stage and we're snapped to attention. I remember sitting next to my bosses and we all said, this guy's a star.
Yeah.
He's got it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people walk away from that show and don't do well. It's really hard to do well in an industry show.
We get anxious when we have nominations for that because we'd like to think that all of our artists can deliver live, you know, but some just get daunted by the room, especially because it's 1,200 radio programmers out there. They're watching their future in front of them, and if they screw up, and of course that can screw with some people mentally, we don't worry for one second about putting Chris on TV or in front of anybody. We don't worry for one second. But coming back to the Drunk Girl comment, I in fact went out about 2 or 3 weeks ago with Chris to see a show of his in Illinois, and I always stand at the soundboard, and what I do when I go to concerts is I stare at the audience at least half of the time. I want to see if they're engaged, if they're singing lyrics. I want to know what's going on.
Where do you position
on.
Yourself?
At the soundboard.
At the soundboard.
Yeah, front of house, as we call it, which is a great place right in the middle. So you got enough people behind you, but you can tell if people are standing up and engaged in front of you. And when he brings it down on Drunk Girl – You get to find out how great of a singer he is. And I know he's sitting here, and I'm not going to do anything to kiss his butt. I don't have to kiss his butt, right?
I don't take it like that.
We're stuck together
it.
No matter what. This guy is a contender right. as a singer. And while he's going to do these rowdy shows, and I encourage that and the energy and all of that, I can't wait till we have another album or two with another three or four of these songs that get to have his voice shine, like Holding Her, you know, these incredible vocal moments, because there are a lot of people who can be rowdy all night long and they can't sing. Right. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of singers who are great voices and they're boring as get out, mm-hmm. all get out. He's got both. And it's going to be so fun to watch the development over a career of the exposure of these songs that he's writing. And he's a great writer. But I just want his voice to get heard more and more in the mellifluous delivery of these mid-tempos and ballads. I'm not asking him to do 100 of those, but I definitely think his show benefits from that diversity.
Thank you very much.
And the fact that you're a musician in this Thank age you. Of lip syncing and all gizmos and gadgets that you play, you sing, you play the harmonica, plays the heck out of the harmonica, which, you know, growing up with artists like Dylan and Springsteen, we're harmonica fans.
And me too.
I don't know how many people in country music are using it, but...
Kix Brooks was like the last one that really did it in a big way, and he plays great, by the way. But, you know, he was never really recognized as a harmonica player, for the best of my knowledge, and I think he's a great harmonica player. Mm-hmm. But I think it was so overshadowed by probably Brooks and Dunn's success, which was great. But it's just what I do. I mean, I started out as a bar singer, so you have to just figure out ways to make extra money.
Get attention.
The only way that I got attention extra and made extra money was picking up a Cracker Barrel harmonica and learning it. That's a true story. And so my tips started quadrupling, and you know, I thought, well, okay, I'm a harmonica player now. I couldn't tell you, if you asked me right this very moment to teach you something on harmonica, the best I can teach you is just put air into it and pull air out of it. I'd have no idea anything
How
about it.
Long ago did you start playing?
When I moved to Nashville.
For anybody who doesn't know, you grew up in Missouri,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in southern Missouri, and with no musical influence or culture, really. So, it was just Pentecostal church revivals and things of that nature. I was a punk rock kid from an early age because I had to be. And if you wanted to break away from the mold, you just went for the furthest thing away. So I became a Sex Pistols and Ramones fan. And then I was born and bred with country. I mean, I was born knowing what All My Rowdy Friends Are Coming Over Tonight sounded like. I was not born with what Hank Williams Sr. sounded like, so I had to find that out on my own. I found that out through punk rock and heavy metal.
Well, next time I'm at one of your concerts, will you do God Save the Queen?
Yeah, sure. It's so funny that you mentioned that. I do cover some of that stuff. I cover a lot of Social D.
I love the Sex Pistols.
And some Rancid and things like that. But what I was getting at is it all led to my harmonica playing, and my musical influences really just stemmed from being a... I mean, to be frankly honest, everybody in rock and roll always says it. Nobody in country ever says it, but angry young kids. And I was really just kind of a happy kid, but I was also I came from the lower middle class. And so when you come from that and nobody ever gives you a shot, you have to make it on your own. That's all I ever did, and that's the kind of music that I'm gravitated towards. And the harmonica was really just a means to, you know, eating.
I love that. And you do a great job with
Thanks.
It.
Thanks.
And you were the face of... What's the organization?
COPD. Yeah. Thank you. I was the face of that because of harmonicas for health, and we did that as a partnership in accordance with the ACMs, which was a great organization. And what most people don't know, and I didn't know this, is I had to kind of learn to re-sing when I first started playing harmonica because it messes with your vocal cords so much. It's just like singing or talking. You're using your vocals all the time. And for COPD patients, it's really incredible. It's really a miracle because they can learn to play a harmonica or just play the basics and they can breathe better.
That is so awesome.
It's pretty incredible.
And I love that you find ways to give back.
I ain't rich, but I damn sure want to be. Working like a dog all day ain't working for me. I wish I had a rich uncle that'd kick the bucket and I was sitting on a pile like Warren Buffett. I know everybody says money can't buy happiness, but it can buy me a boat.
If we could circle back for a second and go back to the great song that started, you're up for New Artist of the Year. Is that weird for you in a way? Because you've been at this a long time, working at this a long time.
I have, but I mean, even outside of the industry, I've been doing it since for even longer. So, but it's not weird to me at all, because what I know and I realize is, and I think it's a great privilege and honor, is that you don't, nobody really knows you in the world. I mean,
I know.
As an artist, you can really think you're cool, but nobody really knows you until you have a hit on the radio. So that's just it. That's the bottom line. And then they still don't really know you until you have another one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, unless you have a Buy Me a Boat, which was a catastrophic thing, that just doesn't happen that often. But, you know, they finally, thank God and thanks to you, you know, they know me. So that's a blessing. But I'm so proud to be a new artist, because I would rather be the new shiny penny than the old washed up toy. I don't want to be the guy that nobody wants to play with anymore. I would rather be the guy that people are like, oh, he's a new artist. Great. I'll take it all day long. Perfect. I wish they could nominate me 3 years in a row.
Perfect way to
sum that up.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, it's, you either get nominated or you don't. So, I mean, wouldn't it be bad if you never did get nominated and you were still a new artist? So that would, you know, I'm thankful for it. Not everybody gets to do it. Like, there's five of us, I think.
There's five.
Yeah. You signed, Chris. Well, that song was released independently first, right? And then you signed Chris.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Tell us how that all went down.
I'll never forget it. And to be clear, Chris Lacey signed Chris.
Who is the head of your A&R department.
She's the senior VP of A&R. For those listeners who don't know what that means, artist and repertoire. Mm-hmm. They find the artists and they work with them to help them you know, record their best work, you know, and collaboratively. Anyhow, I joke about this. So here's the second time I'm in bed and my phone blows up. Okay, I'm in the music business because I'm a night owl. I'm not a morning person. And until I have about 4 or 5 cups of coffee, don't even talk to me because I can't hear anything, right? I'm just sitting there easing my way into the day. Well, there I was at about 7:30 and my texts start blowing up. And it's somebody on our team saying, do you see what's going on with this artist Chris Jansen on Bobby Bones? And I'm like, no, I haven't. You just woke me up, you know.
So, I was going to ask about Bobby's involvement with this.
So Chris can tell you more detail of the story. All I know is Bobby plays the record.
That's the first time you heard this, it.
That's the first. I didn't hear the first time. I was alerted that Bobby had played it, and it was number one on iTunes, not country, overall. And it was like, okay, this one is getting traction. And then I get another text. He played it again. Oh, my God, you know. And then you start reading the reviews on iTunes. And now Chris Lacey is involved. She wasn't the one who was texting me. It was somebody in our marketing department. And now I guess like every label in town, all right, let's get Chris in here as fast as possible, yeah. Right? And he's getting a phone call from every label. And this is not how the process works normally. There's I don't know if the word orderly is proper, but, you know, there's a getting to know you, getting to know all about you. No, get him in here. I want to know who wrote that song that's blowing up, right? And, you know, my recollection, and Chris can help refine this, is that Chris Lacey knew him from his days at Tootsie's a decade earlier.
Wow.
And had conversations with him akin to, you're incredibly talented, you just need the music, you just need the songs.
Yep.
So we weren't getting to know him that day. God bless Chris, because she's out there having this kind of getting to know people, you know, and quite often, you know, A&R people, they have to say no. Just like radio people do to us when we're playing, ask them to play our singles. They have to say no 100 times a week. But she knew he was talented, and so everybody was going after Chris, and we did everything to make sure he understood what we thought we could do to deliver for him, and thank God he chose us. I mean, seriously, you know, you start off with a song like that, that's just rarefied air. And people, I wish we could take a picture of my office, but there's the boat, the Buy Me a Boat.
That's right.
That got delivered to me on my shelf. My office is a
plastic boat.
Crazy.
I was asking where an actual working desk was in here. I don't see one.
Yeah.
That's actually a Bass Pro boat, too, which is so funny now we're affiliated with Bass Pro.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's awesome.
And there's Chris there in that photo. Yeah. But anyhow, it was like what I came to realize very quickly, because Buy Me a Boat was a lightning rod, was he's a great writer. And so there was going to be more than one, right? Because I really don't want to flash in the pan, and I'm not in the business of signing an artist because we have a hit. You know, I'm not looking for one-hit wonders in our life. We want somebody who we think can imagine being on Madison Square Garden. You can see I go on and on, don't I?
I love it. Please.
And that gets... helps get fueled by somebody who not only knows who they are, but happens to be able to write songs that help describe them. I mean, if you listen to his work, there's so much honesty.
Well, congratulations, Espo, on signing him and doing such a great job of nurturing the artist. It sounds like you have a great artist and executive relationship here.
Oh, we do. Well, that's the reason I signed here. So to answer the question from my side of things, and by the way, thank you, because everything you said was exactly spot on. I signed here because I liked him and I like Chris Lacy, and that's it. I mean, that was the reason I signed here. I like to work with people who also, I hate meetings, and so I'm just not going to take a lot of meetings, and I just not going to do it. And so they were like, can you come in on this time, at this time? And I said, yes, of course. My wife and I love Chris Lacy because I think she has the best ears in town. My wife was A&R as well for years at a different record label.
And your wife's name is Kim, right?
Kelly.
Oh, Kelly, right.
Yeah, and so we've all been friends in the same circles, and we just have a lot of respect for her, and of course have a lot of respect for Espo. Obviously, he's in the position at that point that garners respect, but I didn't know him yet. But when we came in here, I mean, that was just it. I didn't have to take any other meetings anywhere else. You don't have to do that when you know. So we shook hands on the notion that, and really just laid it out a template, just kind of in the air, that I'm going to write my own songs. I'm going to sing my own songs, and we will not live and die by the sword. We will live and die by the song. And so that's what we do. And that's just how we do it, and it's been so easy. And the creative process is extraordinarily awesome here, because I know a lot of my friends, I mean, like currently, who are in situations with record labels are having success. They're not enjoying the success because they're being led one way or the other. I don't get led here. We lead each other because we're a team. Like, teamwork makes the dream work, and my promotion guy in the Southwest, Ray Vaughn, always says that, and I live by that. It's really a great mantra. And that's really the way that our relationship is personally, Espo and I, and then the relationship within Chris Lacy and my wife and I, and just the whole label in general. It's not about an I thing. It's not about a me thing. It's us thing. And that's how we win here. And it's really an incredible thing. I had to learn how to work in that kind of environment. I'm an A personality, so it's tougher for me. But once I got a grasp on it, and I got it pretty quick, it just works a lot better. And so the song process, you know, everybody, I think, feels invested and really, really has ownership and winnership, if that makes sense. I don't think we ever do any kind of decisions in between Espo and I, or Chris and I, or anybody at the label, frankly, for that matter. Like, I wouldn't do it if they weren't on board, and they wouldn't do it if I wasn't on board. I mean, that's just we have a great understanding like that.
That's the artist always wins, but we like to have discussions.
Yeah,
but we can't ask him to do something we want, or he's not himself. You know, that's our mantra over here. You know, the artist has to know who they are, and all we can do is encourage them to bring the best of who they are out. And I might add, it didn't hurt that before our first meeting was over, I busted out a guitar, and he and I were singing Springsteen songs together.
It just was a natural fit, you know? I mean,
what was the first Springsteen song you did together?
You started playing it, and I picked up a bass and just kind of started picking along. This guy can play anything that Springsteen ever wrote, sang,
I guess,
recorded,
I didn't know that.
Thought about singing. this is the biggest Springsteen fan of your life, but, you know, I don't know. The relationship is just good here. And I honestly, even if you were sitting here, I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it.
I could feel it. Just the chemistry between
you two. Yeah, it's good. It's easy. That's the great thing he mentioned about, you know, we're such an open book over here. That's the great part. I am such a, I'm the type of human that if you tell me how I have to be, you can forget it. It's over. Like, we're not, it's not going to work. And with this, this house with Warner, with him leading it, it's amazing because it's just, you just do you and hopefully it works. See, the weight's on my back, which is a, it's, that's okay. That's a great burden to carry.
You've got a great relationship.
That's how you find out who you are.
I love that.
How, I know we're running out of time here. There's a couple other, there's a lot of other things I want to get to, but there are a couple I definitely want to get to before we wrap. How do you guys decide where we go next? As to the next level, I mean, what are you always strategizing about that? Taking the artist to the next level.
I would say this, that we have a metaphor here, and this is not just because I was a New Yorker for 30 years. I think everybody in the world has heard of Madison Square Garden, and the metaphor is, what's the road to Madison Square Garden? What are the building blocks that we need to do? It's a combination of things, from, you know, playing smaller places to slightly larger places to, you know, and getting the proof of people being willing to plop down real money. Because, you know, there are a lot of artists who can just play festivals and make a decent living. But the real proof is, are they willing to pay to come see you, you know? And will the artists who are in a better position currently, do they see in you somebody that they really think you would add value to the their concert experience by putting you as the main support, right?
Yep.
Obviously, it's the music, you know? We've got great songs on the current record, the second record from him, and he just sent us in five songs that we're all going, holy crap. Well, maybe we got to go after one of these next, we'll end up having those kinds of conversations.
So you're already thinking about the next album then.
Yeah, and thank you, by the way. I appreciate that, and it's good to hear. It's validating to hear not only you, but in, you know, everybody else that has been really excited about it. He's right. And
it seems like everything's just coming together for
it
you.
It really is. Honestly, I'm going to be frankly honest with you, and I hope you print this. I am a Christian, a man of the Lord, and I am so grateful for all the blessings that we've gotten. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, really, we in my house, we live and die by prayer and faith, and everything else is icing on the cake. And oh, man, things have just lined up. I don't know what kind of peace is on our family right now, but we really got it. And so I'm thankful for that.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. It translates into the music. And that's not to say I don't care what anybody else believes, because I don't. Everybody for themselves. It's just, that's just how we do it. And God, I'm thankful. But I have been such a good headspace because of that. And with everything going on, and there's been a lot of highlights in the last couple months, but I will tell you that it has really affected my writing in a positive way. Chris Lacey came to me. She said, okay, we need to kind of start, this is how we do it, kind of start thinking about the next record. He's not, like, Espo and I are not even talking at this point on that kind of level, right? Mm-hmm. And Chris will say that because that's what she does.
Right.
And I, you know what I do? I go, okay, and a switch flips inside of me. If I'm ready, and usually I'm ready because I like to move fast. We live in a fast-paced world, and you will get sidetracked so quick. But I go into the writing room at home every day when I'm off tour. I fly home every night. And my wife books my calendar up 2 and 3 weeks out, and I write every single day. And then I write about 30 songs, and I bring them in, and about 5 of them are okay, and about 5 of them are great, and the rest really suck. And we just whittle down, and I bring them into the label. And this is how we pick songs over here, which is amazing. Mm. They let me write my own stuff, which not a lot of people get the privilege of doing, and it's an honor for me. And I really, that's just how I do things. And so I turn in a whole handful of songs, and I say, okay, go pick what you like. And that's it. And then they pick them, and then we got 5 that he loves, and I'm like, off to the races. Here
just
we go.
As a listener, you guys have explained that whole process and dynamic between the artist and executive. I think it's a treat to listen to, and I really appreciate your time. I've got to mention Fix a Drink before we leave, because that's one of your hits. And when I heard it the first time, I was just down about, not down, but there were a lot of, like, Hey Girl songs out at the time.
You there look were great a lot of Hey Girl
jeans.
Songs. You're right.
Right.
And I was audibly in the song.
And I hear that song, and I'm like, thank God, we've got this is a country song.
Thanks, man.
It was just so refreshing.
Thank you.
I love
actually
it.
Hated that song when it first was on the record, which was just kind of funny how that happens, because artists, from the best of my knowledge, generally, like, would gravitate towards something that's not the number one hit, right? Okay. I have quickly learned to gravitate towards the number one hit instead. I have a naturally artsy fartsy mindset, so I have to really I have to go back. It's an equal balance. But with Fix a Drink, I was like, this will never work. Nobody will ever play that. It's too simple, right? And then it was like, boom, it was out. It was number one. And it was like, whoa, what just happened? But I quickly became to love that song because this is how I judge them. I play them live. And if people are singing them and loving them, then they must be a hit, right? And Fix a Drink was just that thing. And so I said, well, I love it now. And so it took about 2 weeks after we recorded it. And I was like, I'm totally in. And thank God it worked.
And congratulations on the Grand Ole Opry.
Oh, man, thanks.
Oh, yeah.
What a
big deal.
It is. It's, you know, this 2018, as if it couldn't have gotten any better with the noms and all these kind of things. The Opry, there were two things that were important to me in this lifetime of playing music for a living. One was being on the radio and having hit songs, which I'm thankful to be doing. Great team, and thanks to radio. But secondly to that, I wanted to play the Opry, and I got to play that so many times. And then membership was something that I got to be frankly honest, I kept in the back of my head like it's probably not going to happen. That way, it's like setting myself up emotionally in case it ever doesn't. I'm not disappointed. But then it did, and it was a total surprise. And it really blew my mind, tore me apart in a good way, and it put a stamp in country music that nobody can ever take away. So,
and at the time, were you the youngest member inducted?
I still am, yeah, still in the youngest member. Dustin Lynch was just inducted. I saw him last night and gave him my first big hug since his induction, and I think it's great because he's a great ambassador, by the way, for the Opry. He really loves country music, but I will say that I'm still the youngest member. I'm really proud of that, but you know, the Opry holds a special key in my heart because it's my gateway, honestly, to the new school and the old school at the same time. And I'm a lot of that when I wake up in the morning anyway. So when they say it's like a family and it's like coming home, it really is like coming home for me. I don't have to really worry about anything. I just let it go and sing my hits.
Well, congratulations. That's so great. Congratulations to both you guys on a great year. You've had a great year, both of you.
Yeah, it's been a good
John year. Esposito, Chairman, CEO of Warner Music Nashville. Chris Jansen, up for 3 Country Music Association Awards.
Thank you.
I hope you bring home 3 trophies that
thank
night.
You.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you. I feel like I already won. I mean, I really got to tell you, I appreciate that, but I feel like I already won. I never got nominated for a CMA before, so just getting nominated is winning to me, and if we get to bring home a trophy, that's sweet, because I will, you know, thoroughly appreciate that as well.
Good luck to you both down the road.
Thank you very much.
All success to you. Thanks for doing
this. This is Jim Asker on the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. Thank you, everyone.
I turn on Fox News and then CNN, but it's the same dang thing all over again. The world's in the toilet and the market's in the tank. Well, I can't fix that. No, but I can fix a drink, pour it on ice, mix it on up and get you feeling right. I can get you buzzed, I can get you smiling, I can make you feel like you're sitting on an island. I can make it fruity, or I can make it strong. All you gotta do is tell me what you want. Put it to your lips, take a little sip, and tell me what you think. Yeah, I can fix a drink.
Chris Jansen on the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast, along with Warner Music Nashville CEO and Chairman John Esposito and our own Jim Asker. Great interview. Again, getting into the heads of artists and labels together. And next week, another country star. We're going to do it again. Absolute superstar next week. Keith Urban on the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast next week.
You sound surprised, as if you didn't know that was coming.
No, I knew it was coming, but I'm always so impressed when Jim gets executives and artists together. Keith Urban's one of the biggest country names you could get. So next week, Keith Urban coming up on the podcast will be number one. Is Maroon 5 going to be number one for a second week? Does Drake go back to number one? Does Juice WRLD, as we're talking about, does Lucid Dreams make its way up? It seems at the moment, as we're recording this here on Tuesday, lots in play for next week. So we'll find out. Again, the Chartbeat Podcast Hotline.
Ooh, you better call the Chartbeat Hotline, 212-493-4201.
That's the number. For any chart questions and comments, have a good one about Janet Jackson waiting. I want to play that one coming up. So,
speaking of Janet Jackson, yeah, we're going to throw out a little Chartbeat trivia. Last Sunday, September 23rd, was the week back in 1989, Miss You Much entered the top 10, the first of Janet's 18 consecutive top 10, something that no artist still to this day has been able to do.
Keith Urban on the podcast next week. Sounds like Janet Jackson taking us out this week.
Yeah, never a bad time for Janet Jackson, who actually is performing this weekend at the Global Citizens Fest. Cardi B, current Hot 100 chart topper, The Weeknd, Shawn Mendes, a few others will be there as well. I guess in honor of Janet's 18 consecutive top 10 streak. Should we play the first?
I hear it, Miss You Much. It reminds me of this time of the year, fall starting, summer ending. She came back.
All right. Well, yeah, hitting the top 10 this week, 29 years ago, back in 1989, on its way to number one, where it'll hold on for 4 weeks. This is the first single from Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation 1814, Miss You Much. And we'll miss you much until next week.